going to start off the question and answer session. We have a number of questions typed in. I'm actually going to go back up to the top and start off with the questions for Lee to give Diego some time to digest the questions that have come in for him. So if you give me a second, I will find the first question. And, okay. Lee, the first question for you is, you added another ship, 12 to 13 ships. What is the cost of a new vessel and the payback period for the fuel savings?
Ooh, I didn't see that one when I reviewed them. Typically a new vessel, you're talking about $150 million, but that varies a good bit depending on the size and intended trade for that vessel. In terms of, I don't really know how to answer the question there, but I'll be happy to discuss that with that person offline if it makes sense.
Okay. The cruise ship industry has constructed vessels such as the Queen Mary II and the Oasis. How about the container vessels? Can they be constructed to the supersize?
We actually, about 3 years ago, launched a class of 8 vessels, the first of which was the Emma Maersk. We quote vessel size in terms of the number of containers that you can put on board. So, for example, the largest vessel that can go through the current Panama Canal can carry about 4,500 of those 20-foot containers. The Emma Maersk can carry 3 times that, or close to 15,000 20-foot containers. And they're powered by very large, low-speed diesels, 110,000 horsepower, so some of these are real behemoths.
Okay. The next question for you is, wouldn't reduction in black carbon also reduce greenhouse gases?
And again, I saw that question come in, and I'll be glad to chat with that person offline. Black carbon is typically reduced when we do a fuel switch, so it's a more complex pollutant to deal with. Black carbon also has a shading effect when it's at high level, but then once it falls onto the glaciers, it tends to accelerate melting. So it has climate impacts, but they're more complex than what we typically think of in terms of CO2 or methane or the other classic greenhouse gases.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to move on to some questions for Mike now that I see next. And again, if you think of additional questions for Lee's presentation, continue to type them in. Mike, the first question for you is, what does BCO stand for? And I know you answered that, but if you want to just mention it again.
It stands for Beneficial Cargo Owner, and that's a government term that came in about 4 years ago as part of the Safe Ports Act, where they, quite frankly, and hopefully no one from Walmart's on this call, but it was the Walmart, aiming at Walmart and some of the big shippers who were not taking charge of their of the ownership of the cargo until it actually arrived on their doorstep, even though they were indirectly responsible for making sure that having that cargo, that supply chain initiated. Real quick also, Jennifer, in terms of that one question about the mega vessels, I saw that Lee's right, but part of the issue in terms of can it be made bigger is, A, you got the Panama Canal issue, but a lot of the ports, in terms of the capacity of ports, especially on the East Coast, they're going to have trouble getting the bigger vessels in. The inland transportation infrastructure is not capable of handling the surge loads that those vessels came in. I cited my 3 unit trains that's 100 containers. 300 containers, and you're all of a sudden you're now talking with 8 trains. One of those mega vessels can develop 16 trains, 3 trains versus 16 trains. So you have a tremendous surge load on the terminal and the port when those big mega vessels come. So they've reached about the highest limit of efficiency that they can get right now based upon the infrastructure they have to serve, and that's worldwide.
This is Lee. Mike makes a good point, and let me extend that to say that there are sometimes geographical barriers. For example, in New York, New Jersey, you have the Bayonne Bridge, which limits the size of vessels that can currently get in to serve most of the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey's marine terminals. So the biggest vessels can't get in back there. I noticed today that there was just an announcement that they're going to move to the next step to evaluate what to do about that bridge. And then those ship-to-shore cranes, only some of the newer marine terminals actually have ship-to-shore cranes big enough to work those really massive vessels. And right now, most of them are calling on the Asia-Europe run. I think the biggest ones you typically see here in the United States are around 10,000, and that would be on the West Coast.
Okay. The next question, talking about powering for future vessels, have shipbuilders looked for a solar power option?
Oh, well, we're constantly looking for other options. Right now, these very large, low-speed, highly efficient diesel engines are the best thing that's out there. We are testing solar. We're testing alternative fuels. And as you know, there's been one test of a solar sail out there that was on a very small vessel, and you have to have the wind blowing in just a certain direction for that to work. But so there are all kinds of other alternative propulsion methods that are being looked at, but right now for reliability, you can't beat that big diesel.
Okay, thank you.
I saw someone else ask about nuclear too, and of course there you do run into questions about how do you control the safety of the used fuels. Because remember, these are international vessels. They travel the world and are not under the control of a highly regulated and highly competent body like, say, the U.S. Navy. So there would be a lot of hurdles that would have to be dealt with before you could consider putting nuclear into commercial vessels with, say, Panamanian flags or so forth.
Okay, thank you. Before I actually move on to the next question, I did mean to bring up a polling question before. Originally, I was supposed to be asking how you were accessing today's audio, but I do want to know for the future, if given the option, if you would use the phone line or the voice over IP option. I'm going to put that up because that'll just help us account for phone lines in the future. So I'm going to put that up on the side for you to answer while I'm, for all our attendees to answer while I'm going through the questions. We did have a question, what does GHG stand for? That's greenhouse gases. Mike, the next question is for you. Can you please provide references of your data on freight and mega regions?
Yeah, most of that came from the TRB. There's several different committees working on mega regions from the planning perspective and also from the freight movement perspective. I can cite the references. This were pulled out of two TRB reports that I that were recently published, and I'll cite those references and get them to the person to ask.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let me see here. Diego, the next question is for you. Where do we find out more about the Canadian Freight Strategy National Goals?
That's probably for Mike.
Transport Canada, the website for Transport Canada.
Okay. And assuming a PNG goal of increasing rail from 10% to 30% in Europe to reduce the carbon footprint also had huge cost advantages, how much of this is transferable to the U.S.?
Right, so clearly, you know, PNG just claims that they were able to make cost savings as well, but it's not clear how much they actually saved. Now, in terms of the U.S., I think it is definitely there would be cost benefits on the U.S. side as well if they do it at a large scale. But it, you, mostly in Europe, it was driven actually by regulations to put a cap on carbon emissions, or in other words, you know, to put a price on carbon. So with, you know, in the U.S. with no price on carbon, I think that's going to be much more challenging for PNG to actually get cost benefits in switching in the U.S. But it is, you know, there are railways in, are much more emission friendly than truckers are or than trucks are. So clearly, you know, there is the emission advantage and cost as well. There is also cost advantage. It boils down really to the rail, shipping by rail has a much larger lead time. And also, if we look at the example down in Brazil that P&G did perform, the price that they have to pay was the increase in lead time. But that can, with today's supply chains that are, at least the most efficient supply chains that are, agile and adaptable, you have to, this new lead time, has to be eaten up sort of in some other parts of your supply chain. So they could, switch to rail sort of in the U.S., also in the U.S. I don't see a reason why not. I cannot really comment about the actual cost numbers because, those are proprietary and, they're not sharing them.
Okay. The next question for you, Diego. What are the U.S.'s goals in developing the infrastructure on both coasts after 2014, such as more terminals, contract with ocean carriers, et cetera?
That's probably more for Lee and Mike as well.
Yeah, The Marriott is currently looking at what the role the federal government should be playing in developing port infrastructure and inland infrastructure in terms of rail and roads based upon the anticipated opening of the canal and anticipated benefits to individual areas and regions from increased traffic. Listen to the American Association of Port Authorities, virtually every East Coast and West Coast and Gulf Coast port have claimed that they're going to be a direct beneficiary of that cargo. Obviously, that's not true. And so the market is going to play a significant role in determining where that goes. But there's a lot of, first of all, the Heartland Corridor, the Crescent Corridor, the ones we just talked about in my presentation are all aspects that the railroads are gearing up to increasing additional cargo. Most of the port facilities have announced plans of the Southeast ports and the Gulf Coast ports have announced dredge steps, changes, new terminals, and regional infrastructure improvements to handle that cargo. So people are gearing up for it. The problem is right now is not everybody's going to win on that one.
Okay. The next question is, did I see that ports are a large percentage of emissions? Does that counteract the maritime savings?
I saw that. The problem is ports, when you classify ports, there's a lot of things thrown into that. Sometimes the drayage, from a terminal, marine terminal to an inland intermodal facility, maybe across the street, and maybe in Los Angeles case, 7 miles away. It may be on dock. Part of that is the harbor tugs, the bunker fuels that's delivered. Part of that is the emissions for vessels who don't switch over to their auxiliary power and continue to use their mainline main engine fuel to power the vessel at berth versus cold ironing. It's a combination of literally 100 different sources that go into quote-unquote a port. So I know that a lot of ports are greening their terminals, and looking at electric cranes, electric hostlers, storage equipment, and they're still trying to green other areas. But right now, yes, in a global supply chain component, there is no one measurement for a port. There's a measurement for different aspects of that. And again, you have to look at the entire supply chain to break down those components.
And this is Lee Kenberg. Speaking from the perspective of the vessel operators, and we also have marine terminals, and we also have trucks and warehouses, these proprietary tools actually do break down the pieces. So you've got one emissions factor and distance for the ocean leg, and then you'll have an emissions factor for the marine terminal. And then you'll have an emissions factor for the truck. And, of course, if you look at the ports' inventories, and most of the ports do have inventories posted on their websites, you'll see that there is definitely also a contribution due to things like the harbor tugs and so forth. So you have to actually know the contribution at that particular port to be able to do a good analysis.
Thank you both.
But I should also say that a vessel coming, you know, all the way across the Pacific from Hong Kong is going to have a lot larger total emissions than any amount of cargo handling in, say, Los Angeles.
Okay.
The difference, of course, in Los Angeles or any port is that people are there to breathe it.
Okay. The next question is for Diego. Does your... I actually just jumped up. Hold on. When someone else types in a question, it jumps down. Diego, does your presentation imply an important weakness in the effectiveness of cap and trade, since systemic assignment is essential to reducing greenhouse gases, but hard to allocate?
Yeah, that is definitely the case. Even though if you really look at all of the versions of cap and trade that were bounced around in the Congress, that was really not an issue because they were all imposing, a cap more, I mean, at a much more higher level, such as, a cap on utilities, a cap on cement producers, etc. So at that level, the emissions are fairly known. But it definitely becomes much more challenging if you go down at a lower level. And I have already mentioned the PRB's interest or study into, if you want to put a cap on airport emissions, for example, well, what should that cap be? I mean, do we know, for example, emissions for the airports, and not just that, okay, it's also, what are the actual emissions of an airport? Okay, so the inbound aircraft, for example, does that count towards the emission of an airport or it doesn't? So it does, if any version of cap and trade that is to be passed at a federal level, probably will not have that issue. But then, later as cap and trade sort of evolves, definitely allocations of carbon footprint sort of will become an issue, or it will become a challenge, not necessarily an issue. And we know that perhaps a bigger issue with cap and trade is how do you actually allocate initial permits, right? So do you want to auction them out or you want to give them for free? That was, one of the debates in the Congress, for example, that was fairly high on the table.
Okay. We are about out of time. I'm going to ask one more question, and then I know there's still a few questions in there, and what I'll do is I will send them out to the presenters, and when I send the follow-up information out to everybody with the recording announcement, I'll also include the written responses that I've gathered from the presenters on the remaining questions. So I'll ask one last question for Diego. The complexities of detailed supply chain carbon accounting seem daunting in the near term. This is a new but necessary effort for business and industry. Is it useful to have macro-level analyses as a starting point and then refine methods as better data becomes available?
Yeah, so definitely, I do give full credit to SmartWay to coming up with a micro-level, and there's no question, that's the right tool for the right time, and now sort of that is definitely the right time for a tool like Fleet. But now Fleet, the Fleet model sort of has been around for quite a while, and I think I think it is time to start at least thinking, and exploring at a more micro level the actual accounting. And I mentioned that study of that company that, they were aware that there's a lot of aggregation going on, and if you're a shipper and say, and if you think about consumer goods, like the example that I gave in UK, where really, you can compare based on carbon footprint, and those, labels are actually based on your total, life cycle, say carbon footprint with fairly large portion coming from transportation, well, companies, when that level is reached, companies will they will be concerned pretty much about every single ton of CO2 that they emit, and probably they will worry, that the aggregation that's going on sort of could be improved, or it might be to their disadvantage. But again, the Fleet model, I think it's unquestionably sort of is the right model to get started, and it is in place for quite a few years and probably will be used for, many more years to come.
Okay, well, thank you. Like I said, I will get the remaining questions. I think we had like three questions left. I'll get those to the presenters and include that in the follow-up information. But we are out of time for today. I want to thank all three presenters for three great presentations. Thank you everybody in attendance, and thank you for bearing with some of the audio issues. As I said, we'll have all the audio back up and running correctly next month. Unfortunately, this was the guinea pig session. The recorded version from today will be available online within the next few weeks, and I'll send out an email once it becomes available. I encourage everybody to fill out the evaluation form that's up there and send it back to me. And as a reminder, if you are a AICP member and want to receive 1.5 certification maintenance credits for today, please make sure that you are either signed in with your first and last name, or if you are attending with a group of people and weren't logged in under your name, just type your name into the chat box. The next seminar will be held on October 20th, and will be about the Freight Analysis Framework 3. The seminar is currently not yet available for registration, but I'll send out a notice through the Freight Planning Listserv once registration does open in the next few days. So if you haven't done so already, I encourage you to join the Freight Planning Listserv, as that's our primary channel for announcements about the seminars. So with that, thank you everybody, and enjoy the rest of your day.